Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 6th, 2019, and welcome to episode 185 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and online museums, and New Year's, and all sorts of things. So, hello, I'm Paul Hagstrom, normally in Boston, currently in Montreal, and I am joined today by Jack Nutting in Sweden. How are you?
Hello, Paul. I'm doing good.
Excellent. Is there snow there? There's snow here.
I would say where I am in Stockholm, there's not really snow. There has been snow, like there are snow remnants on the ground, like, you know how like the snow hits the pavement and it mostly melts away, but then it hits dirt and it can stick around. People walk across, so it's like if you're walking on a dirt path, it's usually an icy path right now.
Nice.
I was walking down an icy dirt path late last night, and I was like, damn, I gotta be careful. And I did not fall, so.
Yeah. See, I seem to remember there used to be a lot more snow back in the good old days.
There was.
Where is all that snow?
I don't know.
Anyway. So, it is just us today. We are launching into 2019 with the two of us. And so as a host's topic, I was thinking a little bit about just like stuff I wanted to do in 2019 and organizing my stuff into some kind of online thing. And I thought maybe this would be a thing that we could talk about. I haven't actually sat and formulated my own ideas, but just the idea of virtual retro computing. So for things that you can't physically interact with, if there's some rare object or whatever, if you are interested in it in some way, how would you like to see this made available in some way? So assuming that you can't just go to a physical museum and play with the thing, which perhaps people would like to do, I don't know. But if there was some sort of online representation of it, what would it need to be, or what would you like it to be? Because I was thinking about this a little bit, and you know, like thinking about going through my things and taking photos and scanning documents and stuff like that. Is it worth taking videos of everything working? Is it worth taking photos of everything? Is it worth scanning all of the manuals? Obviously, I think worth, maybe that's not the right way to say it, but if you were going to look at something like this, would you care if those things were there or not? I mean, if you have your own thing you're trying to repair, that's maybe a different thing. But I don't know, is this can you think of things you wished were there in other online type things, or have you thought about this at all?
I've thought about it a bit. One thing that came to mind right away was there is an iPhone app that I've had on my phone for about a little bit over a year, I guess. That's an AR kit thing, so it's an augmented reality thing. It's made by something called the Homebrew Club. Let's say about us. Doesn't say much. So some companies made this. They made this app that's called Homebrew Club, and it's got like a list of old computers, and what you do is you tap on one, and then you point it at somewhere on a desk, and then you see that computer like in life size on your desk through your phone. So you can like stick like a pet out there and an Apple III and what else? There's an Apple I, Commodore 64. There's a Lisa, some Amstrads. Like it's not exhaustive. There's like a dozen things, but it's kind of neat because it's one thing to look at pictures. It's nothing to actually get a sense of the actual size of something. You know, stick an Apple I on your desk next to your MacBook and see how big the thing was, right? So that's one thing. Another thing that occurred to me when you mentioned this was, like, there's a ton of emulation, including stuff in browser, all the stuff that's on the Internet Archive, which is really amazing. But I think what's sometimes lacking from something like that is kind of the context around something. Like you can launch up an emulator on the Internet Archive and jump straight into a game, say, you know, so you pick some game that you liked in 1979 in your Apple II, and there you are playing it. But you don't at that point have any manual or anything necessarily. You don't even know what, you know, what are you supposed to do? How should it work? Does this need to have a joystick? Kind of use keyboard, whatever, that kind of thing. It seems like so there's a potential there to try and build up more context around things that are online. So something like the Internet Archive's hosted emulation is just kind of one step easier than say, like, downloading ROMs and disk images and things. But it's still just sort of like you have to know how to do it. You have to know what you're doing once you're inside this emulator that you open up. So that's one thing that comes to mind, like sort of tying these things together somehow. I do remember seeing something, like I'm pretty sure there are like some MAME front ends that will do things like before you launch the game, you can see stuff about the game. You can see, you know, if it was like an arcade game, you can see cabinet art and that kind of thing. Maybe see some other info about it. But it seems like, I don't know. I haven't thought deeply about this, but I think that there's definitely room for growth and a lot more things that could be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess part of what I was thinking too is that, if you get exhaustive, then you sort of run into information overload. I mean, like, right. You know, so if it was something like, I mean, of course, the Internet Archive in browser emulation is supposed to, in a way, allow you to just jump directly to the thing and say, you know, like, send a link to your friend to say, like, check this game out that I, you know, played when I was a kid.
Right.
Certainly there would be, you know, for individual things like that, having like a little bit of a thing you could read would be useful. But, you know, of course, there are lots of things. And if you had like a site for the IBM PC or something, you can imagine, you know, there's so much stuff you could put there. You know,
right.
These are all the cards that you could have put in there, and these are the manuals for all the cards and photos of all the cards and what they looked like when you picked them up. And, you know, and so at a certain point, you know, then you don't want to go too far the other way, because then ultimately it's just sort of like Google.
Right.
So it's a little bit difficult to know exactly how far to go. Certainly everything should be preserved in some way or another. And, you know, I think when I'm going through my own things and trying to figure out what to do, I do want to ideally, you know, take a little video of walking around the thing so that you can see it from all the angles and maybe start it if it can start and that kind of stuff. But
yeah.
Maybe, you know, have photos. It's interesting, actually, you know, like I scan all the manuals and things that I can. But somehow that doesn't actually still get the same feel as just a photograph of the thing. Like, it's nice to actually see what it looks like, you know, on a desk and somehow in a photograph rather than just like a nice clean scan.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I think one thing that comes into play here is kind of like you talk about wanting to preserve everything. And if you scan something, you preserve that thing. But I think it's kind of, I forget the definition of this. There's something like the distinction between data versus information versus knowledge. These are kind of different levels of data can be just sort of, you know, a pile of stuff, whereas information is a more sort of means that you've kind of sorted this data in a way. You've tabulated this data some way. You've given it some structure. And knowledge is more an understanding of how these different pieces of information fit together and work together. And so if we use a piece of software on a piece of hardware 30 years ago, we have experiential knowledge of what it was like to use it, how it worked, how you did this thing. And if all you kind of have is here's a disk image and here's a manual, until you've actually put it together, you don't really have the knowledge of how it works. And I guess that's really hard. That's maybe very hard to transfer to someone without, I mean, how do you give someone the knowledge of how something works without giving them the direct experience of it? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, for some of these things, it's, you know, actually impossible. You know, that if the experience of using an Apple I or whatever is something that, very few people are going to actually be able to do. I mean,
right.
There are just very few things out there.
Right.
But, and I guess the other thing, too, is that one part of the context that's changed is our, you know, the world around us. I mean, so I would probably have a lot less patience with sitting there for 45 minutes swapping disks now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And that was part of the experience, but you know, it's a part of the experience that people might be willing to overlook. But then, you know, then you don't, if you don't have that experience, then you don't have the wonder of the hard drive, you know.
Right. Yeah. You don't appreciate the speed of things until you understand how slow it was before you had the faster thing.
Yeah.
I know when I started getting back into this and I bought an Atari 130 XE a couple of years ago, and the guy I bought it from also had a tape drive and a couple of tapes. And so I hooked up to my TV and showed the kids, okay, here's how you loaded a game before you had, you know, not even a hard drive, but a floppy drive. Here's what a tape drive was like. And it was, what was it? Basketball game. I think it was just called 1-on-1, right? And I had that. I had that on a tape. And it took, I don't know, 15 minutes to load just because tape is ridiculous, you know? And my kids could almost not believe it. Like, wait, is this right? It's taking this long? It's like, yeah, you can hear it, right? Because on the Atari, it's always, you hear all the noise of the tape loading. So you can definitely tell it's still going. It's still working. And then 15 minutes later, you have this game. It's like, wow, that took a long time for something very, very simple. But then, of course, like you said, there's so much more available to everyone now that back in those days, you didn't get a new piece of software all that often necessarily until, you know, obviously later on BBSs and that sort of thing. But when especially for me, as a kid, I'd be acquiring games or whatever kind of one at a time. And it could be weeks or months between getting more. So that one thing that you've gotten, you're going to devote time to, yeah, it takes 15 minutes to load. That's fine, because I'm going to play it all afternoon.
Right. Yeah. You know, fortunately for me, I skipped past the tape era just by a little. So
right.
I started with discs and, you know, and they always seemed acceptably fast to me.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, comparatively, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah. Anyway, well, I doubt that when I'm going through my own things, I'm going to render 3D models and submit them to, you know, ARKit treatment, but
who knows? Maybe someday that will be super easy, right? Maybe there, you know, I've seen some apps that are supposed to let you do that. You can take something and film around it, and it's supposed to make an exportable model for you. I haven't tried this at all, but like, it seems like that's something that is going to get better and easier over time.
Yeah. Well, and you know, actually, I wonder if you could. So, like, the iPhone has this, what do you call it? I forget now what you call it, but like, you know, big landscape. What is the name of this? Scenario, wide photos. I don't know. Anyway, you can hit this
panoramic.
Thing.
Right.
Panoramic is the word I was looking for.
Right.
But it seems like that actually would be designed relatively well for this because it's supposed to stabilize the horizontal. So if you were actually walking around to something rather than trying to show a panorama.
Hmm.
I wonder if that would capture all the sides.
Interesting.
Oh, well. Anyway. Okay. I think maybe that's enough of that topic, unless there were other things you wanted to add.
Yeah. Nothing else really jumps out at me right now.
Okay. We'll see. Anyway, if people have feedback on the like 97% of the obvious things we failed to mention, then let us know. Maybe I'll go quickly on to a couple of feedback things here, too, while I'm at it. So, there are only a couple here. Ian wrote to point out a book by Christopher L. Morgan called Hidden Powers of the Model 100. I think he just had the physical book, you know, in hand or something. And I thought it was, you know, I sort of went and found it on the Internet Archive, and it's actually... it's pretty cool. It's very sort of like nerdy detail about the inner workings of the Model 100. And so, you know, it's sort of like one book out of a gazillion possible books one could mention. But I kind of didn't know about this. And also, it is a level of detail that's sort of deeper than I think of the Model 100 as usually going.
Sure. Yeah, I'm just flipping through it a bit right now. It's interesting. I'm kind of surprised that there is 250-page book about the Model 100 and what you can do with it. But yeah, why not? I mean, it's like anything else. I think we think of it as being, this was a tool that people used to type documents on and then send them up to their newspaper, kind of. But like, you know, in theory, I guess you could use it for just about anything. Why not?
Yeah, and so there's like chapters on how to use the interrupts and, you know, basics and memory maps and stuff. I mean, so I guess if you are actually going to write a word processor
for
this thing.
For it. Yep, cool.
But so that would be, like, I kind of wonder if I'm ever going to do that. I mean, I kind of sort of feel like, oh, this would be a fun project. There are a lot of projects and kind of a finite number of years, but...
That finite number of years seems to be decreasing.
Yeah, somehow. But it would be delightful to actually like kind of actually that yeah that was something I meant to mention before. There's so many little things to know about each individual thing. You know, like if you wanted to put it, you know, back to the IBM PC, you know, web page. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, learning how all these interrupts interact and all these things. You know. That was it's not like it's easier to learn now than it was then. It's
right.
As complicated as it ever was. So anyway, so I thought the book was cool. Thanks, Ian, for pointing it out. Blake also mentioned a reminiscence by Pete Foley, who I guess worked at Apple and had been involved sort of briefly in a little project designing a RISC-based implementation of the 6502. That apparently was, you know, got pretty far along, got, you know, nice design specifications, and might even have outperformed the 68,000. But then it was abandoned because apparently they wouldn't have known what to do with it. Like, they didn't know where it would fit in the world. But it was interesting to see this little story. So it's
interesting
on the BirdSight Consulting page, which is, I guess, this guy's page. Among the other projects, there's a RISC-based implementation of the Apple II 6502 processor. But, of course... any 6502 based machine, you know, could use this presumably.
Sure.
Anyway, it's an interesting idea. Cool. I wonder if this is information that's interesting now. I mean, like, if everything is kind of already mapped out, even if it was abandoned by Apple at that point, I wonder if that could be revived in a FPGA or something.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if there was documentation for it and stuff. Although I guess, you know, there is the 16-bit 6502 that is still sold by what are they called Western Digital.
Oh, Western Digital, yeah. Subversion of 65816, I suppose.
Right. Which, and it seems like if you're going to do an FPGA-based thing, that you want to have a more advanced 6502, it would be better to run with that because that is actually a working chip.
Right.
That it's actually done.
So this was said to be mid-1985. The project started, and I don't know. I guess that's still a couple of years before the 2GS, I think. So, yeah. So this might have predated the 16-bit, you know, 65XX processor.
Right.
All right. I'll leave the listener feedback at that point. But
okay.
Thanks for those things. That was short.
Yeah.
I guess
that's enough.
So we can turn to items of interest, and you can start.
Yeah, so on the Mac, the primary piece of software for emulating the Atari 8-bits has been Atari 800 Mac X for a long time, which is based on the classic emulator that's just called Atari 800. It's available for many platforms. So for a couple of years, since I think Sierra was released 2 years ago, the sound stopped working because the old version of Atari 800 Mac X was built using an old version of SDL, which didn't work with newer versions of macOS. But that has been fixed. There's a version 5.0 that is out, and it's also now hosted on GitHub. It'll have a link to it. So they updated the SDL version to 2 and added some sound and done some other bug fixes. I forget the name of the guy who normally works on it most. I guess he's been busy with other things for a while, but he managed to get back to it. And I saw this mentioned first by someone else who posted in one of the Atari groups on Facebook because he had started working on this, updating the app to use SDL 1.2. And then as soon as he got that almost working, he realized that the original author had updated it to SDL 2. So
nice.
Leap product. So all's well that ends well. And I haven't grabbed it yet, but I will soon, since I get back into the swing of doing my stuff here.
Cool.
Because it's kind of not, it's not much fun to, you know, especially if you're playing games, which is a lot of what people are doing on the 8-bit emulation side of things. Like, it's not much fun to not have any sound. So, good to have it back.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is the one that I have used. And it's a little bit...
Yeah.
I found it a little clunky to navigate at first. I think I might have gotten somewhat close to understanding how to, like, mount tapes and discs and things. But I'll have to refresh my memory.
Yeah, it's kind of got a... It has an interface that's kind of like a... It's like a control panel for set for like you clicking on a disc to enter a disc image into it and that kind of thing. There's sort of like a big control panel thing for setting up all the environment before you start the emulator. You've got to get the ROMs in place, all these things. So it's not really always trivial to get it working. But once you do, it works fine.
Yeah.
And without this having working sound, there really hasn't been another Mac native 8-bit emulator around. The other option is to use Altera, which is in some ways, arguably, maybe a better emulator is what I've heard. I haven't actually run it at all. But then to use Altera, you have to run it in a virtual machine running Windows, or you have to use Wine or a variety of different things. Yeah. And none of that is very satisfying to me. So I'd never do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess I still feel like a kind of an Atari noob. You know, like I so even if all the controls worked fine, I don't actually know how you start an Atari.
Right.
You know? So, and I think there are some things you do to make it start from the disk drive. I don't know, like there's things you have to hold down or whatever. Aren't there some it's not just turning it on?
Yes and no. And I forget which is which now. Like there's a way, well, if you have a disk drive attached and you have a disk in it and you turn it on and there's no cartridge inserted, then it will try and boot from the disk. But the caveat there, though, is that the later machines, XL and XE machines, they have, even if you don't have a cartridge installed, they essentially have BASIC, which acts like a cartridge, installed all the time. And so you hold down, I forget if it's start or option. I haven't been playing with it enough lately. You hold down one of the keys to make it boot up without that, to make it boot up sort of empty, and then it will skip the BASIC that's in the ROM and look for a disk to boot from.
Uh-huh. Yes, that sounds sort of like what I had been discovering when I was trying to make things start. Because, yeah, I think the only reason I've used it so far is to, like, test tape images. You know, like, I had a cassette that I, you know, was an Atari tape, and mm-hmm. I imaged it and wanted to see if it worked.
So, sure.
And it was a bit of a adventure.
Did you get it working?
I believe I did, yes. It was one of those, I think it was one of those Avalon Hill things where they had, like, four different platforms on a single cassette.
Okay. Cool.
Anyway, cool. Well, I have downloaded it, in fact, as we spoke, so I'll try it out. In fact, actually, maybe the SDL connection is enough for me to also now talk about the Contralto emulator.
Sure.
since I was going to... This showed up in... it was sort of in a tweet reply stream that I had... So it wasn't specifically about this, but the Living Computer Museum and Labs has a... they have a nice site with a lot of sort of information about various machines that they have there, but they also have a couple of emulators that they've kind of developed in-house, and one of them is a Xerox Alto emulator. And so there's a link to a GitHub repository where you can get the Contralto emulator. And I thought that was kind of cool, so I in fact, last night did download it and attempted to start it up and was unable to until you have to sort of set up two things. So it's a .NET application, apparently. And
right.
So that's something that means something to some people, but I think it's sort of a Windows side of the universe thing. Yes?
Yes. Yeah. So okay. it's written in C# and low. And so to run it on not Windows, you have to use Mono, which is an open source implementation of the .NET lower levels.
Cool. Is that something that you were familiar with from the past?
This is my
first encounter with it.
Yeah. I mean, you can think of it as being like the JVM in a way. It's not really, but you can think of it sort of like that. It's not entirely unlike it. And so, like, I've used this for example, if you're doing programming in Unity, usually write in C sharp, and then Unity is all built on top of Mono. So the apps that you build in Unity are all done in C sharp and compiled down to sort of a Mono thing that runs on top of Mono. So like if you ship a Unity game on iPhone, it's got like all the Mono runtime stuff bundled inside of it.
That sounds inefficient, but okay.
Yeah. So it adds like 15 megabytes to every game you ship or something like that. But oh well.
Cool. Okay, yeah. So I my first experience with the Mono project was last night.
Okay.
And it didn't initially run until I did a, you know, brew install SDL2. That was my weak tether of connection to what you had just talked about.
Okay.
But also emulation. But yeah, so it was kind of neat. I did manage to get it up. It's fairly rudimentary, and I don't have any idea. So two things. I have no idea how to use the operating system that the Alto boots up.
Sure.
And the second thing is it's deeply dependent on a 3-button mouse, which I do not have.
Oh.
So.
Oops.
But I did. I actually did manage to get it started. And there's some disk images. So there was something I think called like all games or something. Of course, that'd be the one I would pick. So I managed to mount that on disk 0, and through just dumb luck, I discovered that if you hit the question mark, it will give you a disk directory.
Oh, so, okay.
That was handy. And then the file names on there, many of them are like something.run. And so I guessed that if you type the something, it would make it run, and it did. Mm-hmm. And so I managed to see an Alto version of Space Invaders and an Alto version of something else, I think, but I was not able to interact any further. But if you wanted to, you could, and it's really pretty wild that that's possible.
Hmm.
So, because there can't be a lot of demand for this.
No, which makes it super cool that they made it. Like, this is something that I've heard about forever. I've never run one of these. I've never even seen one in person, I don't think. Yeah. This would be a very cool thing to try out because, you know, it's quite legendary as far as being an early graphical environment. That's really neat.
Yeah. So I was pleased to see it. I hope I will play with it more. But also, I hadn't heard of it before now, and it's not super new. I mean, you know, some of these GitHub's commits are like 3 years ago and stuff.
Right.
So I'm probably not the only one who hadn't heard of it.
Nope.
Well, apparently you had. So
I had not. Two of us. So, very cool.
100% of RCR185 has not heard of it.
Yep.
Okay, why don't you move on to your next thing since I snuck an extra one in there.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so we've talked a bit before about, Plato, this online thing from the 80s. Essentially, you know, pre-internet, it was a thing you could log in, you could do stuff. And I kind of remember playing with this a little bit back in the day, but I don't think I didn't have a local phone number to access it. I would have to call long distance to Minneapolis. It's like, yeah. Anyway, someone has now set up, so there's this thing called Errata Online, which I'm not sure if we have spoken about or not. I've seen mentions of this frequently in my Facebook feed for a while. Basically, what they've done is they have created the Plato terminal software for many, many platforms. So you have it for Atari, C64, C128, Apple II, ZX Spectrum. ZX Spectrum. The Amiga is seems to be the latest one that's available for a test. And so they have a server set up. So if you can launch one of these, and then you can go and connect to the server. And so you can either do this through an emulator, I think. Or you can do it if you have a real machine that you have one of these sort of thing that acts like a modem, but actually connects you to the internet.
Right.
And you can do some interactive games with other people, you can do messaging, you can do a variety of things as if it were 1984 or something.
Yeah.
So it looks pretty fun. Their terminal is coming soon, it says, for Android and iOS also.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah, I tried it out some time ago. We definitely talked about it at some point. But
right.
But so one of the things about the Plato system was, I think, you know, it was one of the earliest sort of social networks in a way. There was a way that you could interact online, and something I barely remembered at all. If, you know, I'm not sure I personally encountered it really. But right. So there's a book called The Friendly Orange Glow, which is
right.
By Brian Deere, which is a kind of talking a little bit about this, and I think I've read parts of this. I don't think I quite made it all the way through it yet.
Right. But, yeah, I know we've talked about the book also. I remember that.
Yeah. But so the trick, of course, is with any of these recreations of a social environment is that, you know, you need more than just you trying it out.
Right.
So it's kind of hard to kickstart any of these things, but it does seem like a lot of effort's going into Errata Online and getting the Plato term to connect to it and stuff. So probably worth continuing to mention it to maybe build up more people to interact.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, there is, of course, apart from the versions available for retro computers, there are versions for Mac and Windows and I guess Linux. You probably have to build it, but yeah. So you can actually just run it on your desktop also. And this is what I remember doing before. I know that I've done this. I haven't run this on an Atari 8-bit or anything, but I've run it on my Mac. And in fact, I'm doing it again right this very moment as I'm speaking.
Wonderful.
So, and it's asking me to log in with my username, and I do not remember my username. But oh well. I'll probably just make a new one. It's fine.
Yeah.
Strangely, when I'm logged in here, it tells me that today's date is Sunday, January 6th, 1991.
Interesting. That's cool. You know, there was I don't know if this is still a thing, but there was at one point a news group server that was, you know, sort of set so that it was operating in real time, but like in 1991.
Oh, right. I remember doing that too.
Which I think that is a wonderful idea.
Just like trickling out messages in real time, but delayed by a couple decades.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. So I will mention a blog by Robert Justice. So this is I've labeled this in the show notes in front of us, at least the drop 3 inches corner, because this podcast hasn't happened for a long time. But there's some interesting stuff here. What kind of, you know, re-brought it to my attention was that just a couple weeks ago he posted something about basically cross-compiling for Apple III drivers. So he worked out a way to use CC65 to compile things that you could then directly use on a Apple III disk to drive, like, you know, peripherals and things. And mm-hmm. Before this, you basically had to, essentially what you would do is you would write your program in the Pascal compiler on the Apple III, because that's the assembler that they had. The Apple III is such a goofy thing, but yeah, it was the Pascal compiler was where the assembler was, and it was also buggy and all this stuff. So it's nice to actually be able to use a modern cross compiler to just create this. And I think part of the problem is just it has to be relocatable code, so it's not 100% trivial.
Right.
So anyway, so that's interesting, and actually it's worth just looking through his blog. He's done some other stuff. There's a couple of interesting blog posts from the, you know, it's a couple months before, but about copy protection on the Apple III and how that worked, because that's also kind of like an unexplored area, because there was plenty of copy protection, because there are things, of course, that our businesses wanted to protect their hundreds of dollars costing software.
Right.
There must have been a better, more elegant way to say that, but never mind. But the thing is that, like, none of the wares groups really thought this was of interest, you know, to get Dental Office Pro or whatever it is cracked. So it's interesting to kind of look into it, and it is kind of an unexplored avenue. So Robert's done a couple of interesting things in here. Anyway, just take a look at that if you're at all interested in a new kind of frontier for copy protection and that kind of stuff. And particularly if you're familiar with any sort of Apple II stuff. The Apple III is kind of a weird, familiar alien.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I still don't even know if I've ever actually even, like, been in the same room with an Apple III. Uh-huh. You know, like I know that you're deep into this, but for me it's just like something that I kind of remember. It came and it was like, you know, even more expensive than the Apple II stuff, which already seemed to me at the time astronomically expensive. And then not long after came the Mac, and it's like, wow, what is this thing about? Does anybody want this? Why is this the thing?
Uh-huh.
So.
And then, yeah. No, I think that there were various circumstances around its release that didn't work out well for it. But right. I think it ultimately wasn't, the argument at least is that it wasn't actually that expensive when you consider how like what it would cost to get an Apple II sort of outfitted to do all the same stuff. So
okay.
The Apple III was like the Apple II with all the stuff that people wanted to add to it built in. But yeah, I mean, it did cost a lot if you were just, if you weren't a business.
Yeah, yeah. So. And I was not.
As it turns out. Yeah, neither was I.
Who knew?
The weird thing is, I think the first time I was in the physical presence of an Apple III was not until I was in graduate school. You know, I mean, like, so it was still kind of a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, this was, I guess, 1996, you know, 6 or 7 or something like that. But, you know, so well after its shelf date.
But, well after its heyday.
Yeah. But there was
if it had a heyday.
Somebody in the, you know, in the department that I went to graduate school in just had one.
Okay.
So
why not?
Cool. Yeah. So while I've been talking, you've added a new thing. So Jack,
that's right.
You take the next thing.
I added one thing that I remembered. So our friend Kevin Savitz has posted a fun thing that I just wanted to share. We've talked a number of times about these basic 10-line programming contest things that happen every year. Some German website has these things you can send in. Basically, you write a basic program on any of the classical platforms. And there are a few different categories of what you consider 10 lines of basic code. It could be that it fits within 80 characters, or it could be 128 or 256. I think there are different versions of BASIC that you have shorter or longer logical lines, right? Mm-hmm. For each one given to a single line number. Anyway, I know that Kevin's been doing a lot of these for a number of years. I've never gotten off my butt to actually write any of these things, which is too bad, but it seems like a fun thing. And Kevin also, sometimes plays through some of the submissions and records them, puts them on YouTube, and those are fun to watch. So he posted this thing on Twitter just less than a week ago, that on a long plane flight, he wrote a tool to help him create custom character sets. So on the Atari, one of the common ways to do simple graphics is to make a custom character set, because it's pretty easy to do. So instead of your letters and numbers, you have you know, walls or floors or people or whatever elements of your game. And so he wrote a tool to help him design custom character sets. And the tool that he wrote is also in less than 10 lines of BASIC. So I just think it's fun that he wrote a 10 line BASIC tool to help him write 10 line BASIC games.
That's pretty fantastic.
Pretty sweet. So we'll have that in the show notes. It was pretty clever. I don't know if this tool is available for anyone to use. People asked on Twitter for a link to the code, and he's not replied. So
it might actually fit in a tweet.
Yeah, it might.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a couple of those. There's a magazine called Nibble for the Apple II that had a two-line BASIC, I think, contest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a one-line BASIC contest, too, that might have been even Beagle Bros. But, yeah, I remember, you know, long, long ago when I was young, trying to do these things on the Apple II, the way that the limit was basically just the limit of the input buffer. So you had, I think it's like 252 characters or something before it started flipping out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you could compress out all the spaces and use all the, you know, this print had a shortcut with a question mark. I don't know if that was universal, but on the Apple II, you could use a question mark for print and just everything you could do to compress stuff.
Right.
And actually the other thing, I don't, you know, again, I don't know how much of this is Apple II specific, but on the version of BASIC that was built into the Apple II, there was an if and a then, but no else.
Right.
Even worse, if you ever in a line used if, then you're basically, you're done with that line. You know, like there was no way to terminate the if. So you'd say like if something at then, and then that was it. Like the rest of the line was the condition, you know, the response to the condition. So you had to, if you want to try to do anything within one or two lines that was conditional, you had to do some sort of weird, like, you know, math conditionals or something that didn't actually use the keyword if.
Okay. Was there a ternary operator?
No, well, there's no, if you mean, there was no else, if that's what you mean.
No, so, like the, so, okay, no. I'm just wondering how you would do that with math without using if.
Oh, well, like the kinds of things I was thinking of is like if you want to move up, like you say, like if the character is A, then move up. Then mm-hmm. what you have to do is say like you want to decrement the y-axis by 1 times the key is A.
Oh, okay, sure, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, there's all sorts of it's kind of fun, you know, fun little compression tricks, and you right. know, it's the art of working around the constraints.
Right.
Okay, so since we are now balanced, I will say my one last thing here, which is also short, I think. Someone did a post about preserving a floppy disk with a logic analyzer. So this is someone who has taken and I'm not sure I'm going to have any success pronouncing this, but a Celay Logic 8 logic analyzer, which is some sort of device that you can buy. And essentially the project was, we know that things like the CryoFlux and the SuperCard Pro can get this flux data off of just standard floppy drive interface, you know, so maybe using this logic analyzer, which can also sort of probe for these sort of very quick, you know, low-level signals, you can do much the same thing. And so it's essentially kind of like a CryoFlux by hand.
Okay.
You know, written in Python and running much slower. But
right.
at the same time, it allows you to kind of see, again, you know, like what exactly is happening there. And it's mm-hmm. kind of neat the idea of being able to see the, like you can look at the flux image and say, all right, well, the original person who wrote this disk had a drive that was kind of pretty, you know, the drive speed was a little bit jittery, but then later someone on a different drive, you know, wrote a new file on it. And so you can see that the block usage thing is a very sort of like straight line between, you know, looking at the timing, it's all very even, and everything else, you know, apart from presumably the new thing that was written, is all kind of like jittery.
Interesting. It's really cool.
Yeah. So I think it would be kind of fun. And, I assume those kind of signals you can get out of a SuperCard Pro and a CryoFlux and the other things, applesauce. Mm. But it's still kind of, it's a neat project. Half the stuff in retro computing is really, you know, doing it because it's there anyway.
Right. So. Cool. Sweet.
And that, I think, concludes the news. And so now a word from our sponsor.
Unlike typewriters, the Amstrad 8256 word processor and computer comes with a monitor, disk drive, and printer included. From around $1,099, it's leaving the future of typewriters up in the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. You come into your office, grab a cup of coffee.
Morning, Brad.
And a Xerox machine presents your morning mail on a screen.
What's the mail this morning? This one looks interesting. Let's take a look at this. I'm going to need a couple of copies of this.
Push a button, and the words and images you see on the screen appear on paper.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Fred. You know, Fred, I think everybody on the routing list should see this.
Push another button, and the information is sent electronically to similar units around the corner or around the world. This is an experimental office system. It's in use now at the Xerox Research Center in Palo Alto, California. Soon, Xerox systems like this will help you manage your most precious resource, information.
Anything else? Flowers. Well, what flowers? My anniversary. I forgot.
And we're back. Okay, so it is time for the retro computing gift idea, and I have a sort of a weird one here, which is the gift idea is essentially to print out this card game and send it to your friend, whoever it is you're buying the gift for. But so this is John Aycock's 6502 The Card Game, which it doesn't seem to have any sort of homepage. He tweeted about it at some point, and it's a direct link to a PDF that you can print and then cut into cards. And each individual card has a 6502, you know, opcode on it. So like and then it's a little description, you know, and with accumulator. It has 2 bytes. It takes 3 cycles. It is in zero-page mode. The idea is basically you cut all these things out into cards, and then at the very end of the PDF, there's a, you know, a little thing that has the rules, and it says the object is the player who plays all their cards first wins. You deal 8 cards face down to each player, and then essentially what you're trying to do is match. So, and you match, you can match in any of a number of attributes. So you can match in, you can match exactly, you can match in number of bytes, number of cycles, addressing mode. And yeah, so there's some extra cards like pop and new and things that, you know, affect the cards that you're holding.
This is pretty funny.
Yeah.
I like it.
It's pretty amusing. I can't vouch for it being fun.
Right.
but it's an amazing idea. What surprised me, though, is that it doesn't seem to have the actual opcode. Like, maybe I used the word opcode, but what I mean is that, like, the mnemonic is what it says on the thing, like LDA, right?
Right.
But I don't see any A9s anywhere.
True. Yeah, it doesn't actually give you the opcode. It just gives you the...
This is not a good study tool.
No, not a study tool. That's too bad. It's very close to being like flashcards full of 6502 information, but it doesn't have the opcodes. Maybe we should contact this guy.
Right. Exactly.
That could be the next version.
Because it does, it might actually be not bad for remembering how many cycles things are, because that's one of the bits of information that's on here. But so, a little card game to provide to your friends or soon to be ex-friends. I don't know. Okay. And it's free, though.
All birthdays for the coming year are solved. I know what to give everybody.
All right. And now I guess after that, we have eBay auctions. Mm-hmm. And the numbers of auctions that we have individually here is somewhat unbalanced.
True. There's an inequality here.
Insofar as I have all of them.
Okay. You can present what you want, and I will just give color commentary on what I think of these things. It's fine. Okay, I'm into it.
That sounds good. All right, well, away we go then. So the first couple of things I had are Raspberry Pi based. And so the first one is called an Apple II Raspberry Pi carrier card. And I thought this is sort of potentially interesting. There exists something called an Apple II Pi, which I'm not sure it's available anymore. It may be available again at some point. Anyway, the main thing is the Apple II Pi card is a card that you put in your Apple II. It sits in a regular expansion slot, and you attach a Raspberry Pi to it, and that it basically serves as like a serial communication to your Raspberry Pi.
Okay.
So what that means is that you can use your Apple II as a terminal to your, you know, the Linux machine sitting inside.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that point you can tweet and, you know, use Emacs and all the other stuff you might want to do. Or VI, I suppose. So I thought, well, maybe this Apple II Raspberry Pi carrier card that is being listed on eBay, it might be some sort of alternative to that. It's, you know, shaped like an Apple II card. You plug it into an Apple II. What the auction says in the description is, it's a Raspberry Pi carrier card for the Apple II bus. And there's a link to the YouTube video of it running. And once I kind of understood what was happening, it seems to me like there is pretty much nothing going on here except power. Like, it doesn't actually connect to... I don't understand. I still don't understand. Actually, I thought I understood it. It's a very complicated looking card, but it doesn't interact with your Apple II in any way except to get power from it.
Really? That's the only thing it does.
It seems to be. There's a bunch of it has JTAG headers and stuff. Like, I don't understand. Yeah, right. So onboard 20 pin standard JTAG connector for ICE debugging, but it doesn't seem like it actually does anything.
Hmm.
Okay, so maybe this is actually less interesting than I even thought, because I don't understand it to this huge degree.
So it's like, if you're a person who wants to carry around an Apple II
instead of that wallwart,
in order to use a Raspberry Pi that's hidden inside the Apple II, and plug a keyboard, a USB keyboard into that, and plug a monitor into that through HDMI, like,
Yeah, it's very bizarre. Like, I feel like I must be missing something because it doesn't seem like there's any interaction with the Apple II at all, except that it gets power from it.
Right. Have you watched the YouTube video yet?
Yeah. Well, and actually, if you look at the card, there isn't anything on it. It's just traces.
Right.
It's it's, you know, and there's some places you can solder stuff, but otherwise you just like stick the Raspberry Pi on it. So maybe you could use it as a development card, but it doesn't do anything by itself, and it certainly is not an Apple II Pi replacement. So
no, yeah, and when they move forward, so the YouTube video is titled "Internet Access on Apple II,"
yeah,
using JPL Apple Raspberry Board. But if you look through it, I mean, clearly what they're doing is running. It's just running the Raspberry Pi, the OS that's on it, attached to a monitor.
Right.
The fact that it's mounted in an Apple II seems to be completely irrelevant to anything. I'm yeah. just, I'm really, really puzzled. Really puzzled.
Yeah.
Like, you could just as well have a thing that would, like, here's a way you can mount a Raspberry Pi inside your refrigerator. Not to interface with your refrigerator, just like a cool place to have it, and then have a cable running out of your fridge to a keyboard and a monitor, and you're all set.
Yeah, then you can make a YouTube video that says, you know, access the internet with your refrigerator.
So strange, but maybe we're missing something.
Yeah.
As you say, it's hard. Why would anyone make it otherwise? What is it for if it's not strange?
So if anyone knows, or if you are the person who listed this. So I don't know how much of this is going to actually stay in the final edit, but at the very beginning when we were looking at this, the first thing that I linked to turned out to be actually an auction of just one of the other ones that was bought. Like somebody bought it and then said, what is this thing? And then turned it around and was selling it for $5 less. So,
how interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, the second thing I have is also Raspberry Pi related, but does seem a little bit more reasonable. It is called an SD2 IEC killer, but actually what it is a Pi 1541. And so it's a disk drive emulator for the Commodore 64. And mm-hmm. I think the 1541 also can be used with the VIC-20. And,
yeah.
At any rate, it's basically a little kit. It's a little PCB and a kit that you mount a Raspberry Pi onto, and it will run a 1541 emulator. And the kit comes with a board, and it comes with the connector that you need. So you need the cable. But if you have an actual 1541, that would work. And you need to be able to solder.
Right.
So that's kind of cool. This, I think, is kind of neat. It is a $29 buy it now. Shipping from Norway.
Mm-hmm. So. I noticed on the little board, it says "Brukt moped" upside down, which doesn't make any sense to me at all. It must be some sort of Norwegian joke. That as a Swedish speaker, I don't quite understand what they're getting at.
Interesting.
Like I think like moped means moped. Brukt right. probably means brukt. It sounds like it means a word that means like. Usage in Swedish, so like it has no. I don't get it.
Yeah, I thought actually Swedish and Norwegian were relatively close.
They are. They're really close, but there are a lot of words that are false cognates that you think it means the same thing and it doesn't quite. So
perfect.
Yeah, it's great. No confusion there at all.
All right. Well, so if any Norwegian speakers, if you know what the joke is.
Yes. Someone please tell us what "brukt moped" is supposed to mean.
There's also a thing that says, near that it says, Ole D. So, also somewhat Scandinavian, I think, right?
Yes, Ole D.
Yeah. I understand that was a rather poor attempt at a joke by me. I understand that it says OLED. But
that's good. Pretty good enough.
Yes, sufficient.
We're not paid for our comedy here.
That's true. Okay, so the next two things I will mention are Amstrad themed. So there's an Amstrad Emailer Plus that is available. This one is shipping from Hungary, and I think I've heard of this before. This is a device that it's like a famous flop. So it's a phone that you can do email with, and apparently you know Lord Sugar of Amstrad. Was completely obsessed with this thing.
Okay.
And, you know, so it hit the market at a time when it just, you know, it wasn't cheap enough. It had sort of a proprietary email interface. So you could only, you had to sort of like buy service from them. And anyway, so it's got kind of like a history to it. And it looks sort of interesting. It has a pull-out keyboard that looks a little bit, you know, Sinclair-y, I guess.
Right. Is this sort of a mid-90s kind of thing? I can't quite place when this probably is, but it seems, just by the look of it, I guess, mid-90s.
I think it was, I think I knew this at one point and forgot, but I think it's like 1991-ish or something.
Okay.
This one is the, Amstrad Emailer Plus. Oh, no. Does it really say that? I think it says launched in 2000.
What?
Wow. Yeah, so you can see how this wasn't going to go anywhere.
Right. A little late for that.
Okay.
But the whoever's trying to sell this asserts that it is very rare, antique old.
And I think it might actually be somewhat rare, because I think it was a terrible flop.
Sure.
But
I'm not sure about antique old, though.
Yeah.
It's not that old. Come on.
Okay, so the other Amstrad thing that I had is a Amstrad PCW 8256, and I think this also is, I think this enjoyed a bit more success. This was kind of like a basically supposed to be a word processor standalone thing. I don't think I've seen this before. I might be wrong, but PCW stands for something like, you know, personal computer word processor or something, and it is actually a CPM machine, although I think the decision about CPM was made kind of late. Anyway, it can run CPM things, and this particular unit appears to be relatively complete. It's in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I thought it looks kind of interesting. I don't have any space for it myself.
No.
But.
And there is a photo of it seemingly turned on, but it's not a really enticing photo in terms of what you see on the screen.
Right.
Like, this doesn't look like it's working. I mean, it lights up. It's green. It's a green screen that is lit with a bizarre diagonal pattern. Yeah. Like something's very wrong, but maybe it's adjustable. Maybe it's fixable.
Yeah. Well, the pattern is probably, that's probably the scan lines, but, or whatever you call it, like vertical sync issue. But, this has one disk drive. And apparently the disks are no longer available. So in the description, the person said that, it's been 30 years since they turned this on, but they seem to recall that this is not an unusual behavior for it if no disk is in there.
Okay.
So it seems like there's a chance that you could get it working again.
Okay.
It's interesting because I hadn't seen it before.
Right.
And it also Amstrad.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Here's one. It's a 1977 book, and it is called Be a Computer Literate. I just thought that was funny on its own. It's produced by Bell, I think. But yeah, it's produced in the USA, so maybe the language has changed or something, but Be a Computer Literate sounds terrible to me. I mean, like, in a very ironic way.
Right. What I really like, though, what I see of this is the illustrations. Very colorful illustrations, including a camel, which is drinking oil through a straw from a giant can and has its tail plugged into an electricity outlet on the floor of the desert.
Yes.
I don't understand this at all. But
with its humps as some sort of tape drives.
Yeah. I kind of love it.
Yeah.
What I see so far is amazing.
It's pretty cool, actually. I think it's not an expensive thing. It may well be purchased by the time people hear this.
Right. Definitely worth everyone checking out for the sake of the illustrations, which are mysterious and intriguing.
Yes. And then the name is glorious. So then the next one I thought was possibly interesting as a kind of like a discussion point. But so this is, it's a Next Station Turbo Color, sort of. Mm-hmm. So what it is the Next Station is the pizza box. I don't know if I'm telling you this like you don't know this, but I'm saying this for a wider audience.
For other, it's not just for me.
Yeah. But so it's the It's a pizza box form factor Next computer. And those are the ones that came after the cubes. And I think basically the last greatest version of this was the Next Station Turbo Color, 68040. So what the actual thing in the auction is a Next Station Color box that has been upgraded to a Turbo Color.
Oh, okay.
So outside it says Color, and inside it's been upgraded in various ways. So one is the capacitors have been replaced. The internal hard drive has been replaced with a SCSI 2SD board, so it has an SD card. And the board itself has been replaced to be a Turbo Color 68040, despite what it says on the outside. And it has 128 megabyte RAM. NextStep 3.3 is already installed in the SD card. And so the thing about... Oh, and actually there's a handmade ADB box. So you can plug in any ADB monitor or ADB keyboard and use a VGA monitor.
Nice.
So the thing so what's interesting about this is that I think although there's a lot of aspects of this that, you know, are sort of like not original, if you really just wanted to get one to use, this seems like actually a really good thing.
Yeah.
Cuz I have a Turbo Color, and I have to do all of these things to it, and I'm never going to get around to it. I mean, like, I'm worried about the capacitors leaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm worried about the hard drive failing. In fact, there's something wrong with the hard drive anyway at this point. It always boots to a prompt, and I have to sort of specifically make it start, like, through the keyboard.
Right.
But it sort of seems like this is... It's real hardware. It's real Next hardware with some modern support around it that would be easy to use and just play Doom on if you want.
Sure.
So I don't know. I'm not personally tempted. First of all, they're expensive. I mean, this is a starting bid of $600. So there's, it's not cheap. It might even be actually expensive, but it does have these extra things in it, like the SCSI 2 SD card and the upgrade.
Yeah, like you wouldn't need to, like, you know, this is the thing that is like working and in good shape to use with other things you might already have, like an ADB keyboard and mouse and a VGA monitor, instead of worrying about, okay, what am I going to plug this into? Do I have a keyboard? Do I have a, you know, all that.
And honestly, finding a VGA monitor for this, so the Next had, there was a couple of monitors that they made that went with these things. You know, of course, they're CRT monitors. They're all going to fail.
Right.
So I have an LCD monitor that I have connected to my Next Station, but it was hard to find one that worked because they have to be able to do sync on green, mm-hmm. which is not common. So
okay.
So that's a little bit frustrating. Somewhere there's a Next forum. Oh yeah. In fact, I remember noticing on the Next forum that there are buttons. Like if you're looking at a long thread, you can sort of look at the page that comes after the page you're on or the page that comes before the page you're on. And they really missed an opportunity with that going forward button because it just says Next. It doesn't actually have a nice capitalization or anything. But
oops.
Anyway, but yeah, so I think there is a forum on which there are discussions about like which monitors are known to work and which ones aren't. And I think that's how I figured out which one to get. But but I know I tried a couple that didn't. Anyway, okay, so if you're looking for a Next Station Turbo Color, that might just be, you know, like you could just get and have. This might be one way to do it.
Right.
And then I think the last couple of things I'll mention here are there's a same seller is selling both a Sol 20, and they just are pretty looking computers. I have no idea, you know, to what extent it works. It prints garbage on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So if what you want is a computer that prints garbage on the screen, then this is the one for you. But they're very pretty, with the like wood panel sides and the blue.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem like it's not super expensive actually. It's $850 starting bid, so it's, you know, it's not super expensive relative to what I see these things go for. It's still more than I'm willing to part with. But
right,
actually, okay. So the buy it now on the Sol 20 was $1,110. Dollars for
right.
whatever reason. It's in Milpitas, California.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a, by the same seller in the same place, and for only like about three times as much, a DEC PDP 1144 setup. And That is another thing that I, you know, not only have no space for, but no funds for.
Right.
But it is pretty interesting because it's they say basically it was taken out of operation and then stuck in a closet or something, and then basically not touched. And it seems like it has, you know, it seems in good shape. It's complete, you know. It's the photographs are kind of weird because it's in some sort of room that has a sliding door on it, and it really sort of feels like surreptitious spy photographs of like someone's warehouse that they're going to steal this from. But yeah, I mean it's actually in really nice shape. If you were looking for something like this, and particularly if you were in that area,
right,
it's under $4,000 to buy it, and it's free local pickup. So,
yep, yeah, it does look like it's in very good shape for what it is. So, for a thing of that vintage, for the right person, who knows.
So, this is another one of those things. If you got one of these, you know, this would be like a 2-year project,
right?
You know, because you don't just intuit how to use these.
No, not going to be the most obvious thing in the world.
Yeah. It actually took me a little while to figure out what is the computer in this setup.
Yeah, I sure don't know.
It says all the manuals are available. That's also interesting. And there's a bunch of disc packs, and one of those phones that has the many buttons that light up.
Yeah,
the red hold button. Yep. In the lower left.
Is the phone included? Does it say that?
I don't know.
Hope it is. I
hope it's the entire contents of that that vault.
That whole room.
Anyway.
Nice.
So, cool. I think that was all I had. So that's all right.
Good. Good bunch of stuff, Paul.
Thanks. Nice color commentary.
Thank you.
All right. So I guess we can move to the closing discussions portion. And do you have any things to closingly discuss?
I don't really. I've just been so busy with other stuff in my life that I haven't anything to add.
Okay.
So.
I feel like I've been talking and talking, but I'll talk just okay. A little bit more.
You got something here.
Yeah, I typed in a couple of things. I think since the last time we recorded, I replaced the battery in my Trio 650. Had started to swell, and it wasn't, you know, it was clearly not gonna last much longer. So I took my last you know new old stock replacement and put it in, and I'm kind of thinking I might not buy anymore. I was still able to, like 3 years ago or something, I was able to buy a couple of still, you know, like new old stock real Trio batteries.
Mm-hmm.
But of course they're batteries, and you know, new old stock or not, they're gonna fail.
Yep. What are the physical characteristics of that battery? Is there a suitable replacement that you could be made in some other way, or?
It's possible. I don't really know how standard they were. The ones I got were the ones that said for the Trio 650. You know.
Right.
And of course, all of the devices will always say use only battery part number XXX or whatever, because you know that's the one the company sells.
Sure.
I don't know what I think about the Trio. I mean, it's possible that I could. It's not, basically, it's been sitting. The battery's been there charging for, you know, I don't know what, 10 years? You know, and every year the alarm will go off because I never turn off. There's a particular annual alarm that just always goes.
Right.
And, you know, so, I mean, like, it's still doing its little thing. It hasn't been connected to a network forever. And I don't know if I'll miss it. Will I miss it? I mean,
I don't know.
Like, I could plug it in, you know, occasionally if I do miss it. So, but let's see. I also had discovered, just incidentally, I came across the there's a common legend about the QWERTY keyboard that the reason that it's laid out in this way is specifically to slow you down,
right?
So that the like the typing arms don't actually like jam up, and it's certainly manual typewriters would jam. Mm-hmm. The Smithsonian Magazine has an article from, it's like 5 years ago or something like this, maybe even more, 15, I don't know, long time ago, going over the fact that this is actually just all legend, you know, that the QWERTY keyboard actually existed for reasons entirely unrelated to the mechanics of the keyboard.
Okay.
Sort of a sad day to learn. Like, you know, it was kind of a neat sort of trivia story to have.
Right. Can you give us a basic story of roughly what it was? Was it just random, or was there a particular? Was there some person that felt this was better in some way?
See, now I haven't read it all that carefully, except okay. for the debunking part. But my understanding was that it kind of evolved actually, and it had something to do with the usage of like teletype operators. There was a mm-hmm. couple of other legends along with it that I think like one such legend that wasn't, you know, wasn't about jamming things was that I think it was Remington, or there was somebody that had a, you know, basically they created the device and also had the training courses, and the idea was that if you had a proprietary layout and were the one who did the training courses, then like essentially you had a built-in loyalty, because people would be hard for people to switch.
Sure.
But I think that wasn't even actually it. But anyway.
Okay.
If you want to read it, we can all read it together.
Right. Cool.
So. Okay. Anyway, I think that's probably enough. Oh, whatever. Okay, I typed one other thing. I'll put it in there too, which is that this reminded me, but you know, back on the sort of the palm thing, it reminded me that I had for a while on one of my devices, I had a something called a fiddly stamp, which is a little overlay that you put on your palm, you know, like the normal whatever you call it, the graffiti area.
Right.
That it was basically a keyboard layout that was designed to minimize pen travel. So, like Dvorak, it's different from the QWERTY layout, but. And I actually got relatively good at it. So I'll have a link to the fiddly stamp, because I thought that was kind of cool.
Neat.
So I'm sure I'm terrible at it now.
I feel like I remember seeing this, but I'm sure I didn't use it.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Oh, those were the days. I remember liking Textware, the people who made it. I don't know. I have sort of like a fond, pleasant memory of that, just like that small Palm ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice. I liked it too. I liked little apps we could install on these things. It was good days.
Yeah, I had the Code Warrior, you know, whatever you call it, SDK or whatever for building my own Palm apps, and then I never did anything with it, but I got the updates.
Right. Yeah, I remember I got all the I got the GNU compiler stuff working for it, so I could, I forget if I did this on Mac or on Windows, that I could write software and like I could build a binary and somehow shuffle it over there. Must have been a Mac somehow. I don't remember. It was kind of cool. I had no actual use for doing this. I was not. It was just sort of a, you know, like all this stuff. It was fun, a fun hobbyist sort of thing to do that I never did anything meaningful with. But that's okay. It was fun.
Like reading a disk image with a logic probe.
Yep.
You do it because you can.
Yep.
Okay. I guess we can probably close this out.
I agree. I concur. We may end this session.
Excellent. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this stuff in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. And you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network, which is at throwbackreviews.com. Add a link to be provided in the show notes. You can write a review for us on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
Dave Gorman, and before the break, I promised I would explain quite why I spent Valentine's Day thinking about Alan Sugar. And I will, but let me give you some background on the man first. Now, obviously, most people know him from The Apprentice, but as a businessman, I think he's most associated with the company Amstrad. Now, they were best known for home computing, but for me, they'll always be synonymous with this. This is the emailer. I know it seems weird. It's a phone that allowed people who didn't own or have access to a computer to check their emails. Although quite why someone who'd never had access to a computer would want to check their emails, I'm not quite sure. And I'm really not quite sure why I've bothered putting it on the screen there to show you, because, ladies and gentlemen, I have an emailer here. So you can see exactly how awful it really is. It's basically a thing that everyone's already got attached to another thing that nobody wants. This is weird, and I can see some people looking at it thinking, oh, come on, Dave. It's very easy to mock with hindsight, but this was the 80s. Times were different. This could have been a hit. But this wasn't the 80s. It wasn't even released in the 90s. This, believe it or not, is a 21st century invention. This was released in the year 2000. This is what people in the 60s thought the future looked like, invented at a time when we knew it wasn't the future. It cost 12p to get your emails. One of the things that makes email what it is the speed of conversation you can have. You wouldn't want an email conversation on one of these, not at 12p a pop, would you? Honestly, one of my mum's friends used to have one of these, and she regretted it every single bloody day. When they launched them, they sold for $79.99, which is weird, I think, because I think I'm right in saying that $79.99 was also the age range of most of the people who bought them. And it isn't just me who was unimpressed. According to this article in The Telegraph, the city was unimpressed. It doesn't say which city, but I know at least one lady in Wolverhampton who definitely wasn't happy. According to this, the day Sugar launched it, more than 17% was wiped off Amstrad's share price. Imagine if you came back from a task on The Apprentice having lowered your share price by 17%. I think you'd be heading for the greasy spoon on the back of that one, wouldn't you? Undeterred, 2 years later, in 2002, Sugar launched this, the Emailer Plus. Because if punching yourself in the face isn't getting results, why not punch yourself in the b*** instead? And I'll be honest, I don't know why I've got that there, because I've got one there as well. Plus, ladies and gentlemen. This didn't help much. In fact, according to that Telegraph article, 3 years after launching the first emailer, the share price had fallen a further 95%. This one allowed you to play games for just the price of a premium rate phone call. Games on this in 2002. Games from the ZX Spectrum that had been discontinued in 1992. You can't say that Alan Sugar doesn't have his finger on the pulse, can you?